From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is somebody who 35 years ago created a film that changed the course of popular culture and also asked the most provocative question I can imagine, which is, can a black bat from Detroit find happiness in a white suburban family? The movie we're talking about is Hollywood Shuffle. My guest is its director and co-writer, Robert Townsend. It is a thrill to have you here, Robert. It's always great to talk to you, but let's talk about what the world was like in 1987, because there's so much in that movie that still makes sense now. I mean, you have, during that audition sequence in the beginning of the movie, two guys are talking about being fair-skinned, light-skinned, and how they can't get cast because white people don't believe light-skinned blacks can be, and I love this phrase, street toughs, a phrase we haven't heard probably since 1987. But there's so much of that movie that still feels contemporary.
Well, first off, thank you so much for having me, and good seeing you. We'd have to go 1979, starting there. That's when I got into showbiz. And so the roles that were available for young black actors were the criminal still in the television, the stoolie that, you know, like I was in more pool halls and the names of the characters were always so bad. Boot! Midnight, Eight Ball, Raisin, you know, Raisin, get over here. You know, they had to make sure the name had something black in it, you know. You're Midnight number one, he's Midnight number two. And so those were the parts, you know, because Keenan and I, you know, we were young actors, and what made us laugh.
That's Keenan Ivory Wayans.
Keenan Ivory Wayans.
And is in the movie as well.
Yes. We would audition for stuff, and they would always have the smart stoolie. This brother knew everything. And we would laugh because the dude was like, yeah, man, the dude you're looking for is on the third floor. Yeah, he's got a red hat and a blue jacket. You want any stock tips? You know, because right now I've noticed that. And I'm like, if this dude is so smart, he knows everything, why is he in a pool hall? And so, and we were auditioning for slaves, you know, and that was the other part of it. Like, I just massively, you know, we would do all of that. And then we auditioned for Pimps. We were talking a second ago about Superfly. And I just remember having this audition, and this is when the whole world changed for me. There was this, you know, white director from England doing a pimp movie. And he was telling me, no, you've got to pimp slap her. I ain't got the money. She's holding out on you. You're a bad mofo. And it was degrading. Turn your butt around. Stick your butt out. I know you black guys. Stick your butt out. Stick your butt out. And the audition was horrible. I went to Keenan's house and I said, Keenan, we got to make our own movies. And I had never directed a short anything. And he saw the passion in my heart, in my eyes. And he was like, Rob, you have never directed anything, not even a short film. And I go, if we don't do it, Hollywood will always tell our stories. And then Keenan goes, we can do it. And that's how it started.
Not only does this movie hold up in terms of it being about things that in a lot of ways haven't changed. I mean, unfortunately, there's still slave movies being made. We're waiting for a big one from Antoine Fuqua at the end of the year.
I don't want to get into that.
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation for another episode, but that narrative it still exists as part of the story, the way stories are told about people of color.
Yes.
And what's still incredible about the film, too, is that it changed the way movies were financed. Talk about the fact that you financed this movie with advances on credit cards that you got.
Well, the movie that changed my life was A Soldier's Story, directed by Norman Jewison. It was
Canadian, not British, just so you people.
Yes. get over there. You're a soldier. Oh, boy. I say. Anyway, so Norman just wanted to get the humanity of the characters. It was me. It was Denzel Washington. It was David Alan Greer. A gentleman named Howard Rollins, a really fine actor, gone too soon, and Adolph Caesar. The script was well written, but that movie, we got nominated for 4 Academy Awards. And I was like, oh my God, this is the movies I want to do. I want to do more stuff like this. And my agent goes, Robert, they only do one black movie a year. Be happy you did one, you know, and that was it. And then that's when I said, you know, to Keenan, I said, we'll make our own movies. And I said, it doesn't look that hard. We just need to get a group of guys around us. Like Norman had a group of guys around him. We need some brothers around us, some people around us. And that's how it started.
As you said, you had done it before, which is to say, if you go out looking for people to invest in or go, you're a black man
yes.
who hasn't made a movie before.
Right.
Have you seen the movie before? What are you doing here? I'm sure you got a lot of that.
Oh yeah. Well, people go, how do you know? And that's always the question. It's like, well, how do you know you can do it? And you just kind of know. And so because of Soldier Story, another film called Streets of Fire, and another film called American Flyers that I had done with Kevin Costner. So I was in these films and I had saved my money. And basically, I had saved $60,000, and I said, we're going to make a movie with $60,000. And then I didn't know anything, and we made so many mistakes, but the stuff looked good, and it was funny to us.
We should say, also in those days, you were shooting 16 millimeters. It wasn't like you had video you could erase or delete.
No, we were shooting 35.
Okay.
We were shooting on 35 with leftover film. Norman and Ron Swory from Soldier Story gave me the leftover film when I said, I want to make a movie.
Oh my gosh, that I never knew. They gave you leftover stuff.
He gave me leftover stock. Ron Swory, who's passed away, God bless him, he was like, you know, he called me Bobby T. Bobby T, if you need it, whatever you need, Bobby T, you're going to be a filmmaker. And he gave me all the short ends.
You say short ends that are leftover stock they don't use.
Yeah, I forgot there's a whole audience that doesn't know. A film magazine was 10 minutes. And if the scene was 6 minutes, you had 4 minutes left over. And you couldn't do the whole take again. So that 4 minutes, they would either throw away or give to young filmmakers. And they just happened to be kind and give me all those leftover 4 minutes and 3 minutes and 1 minute and a half a minute. And I used it all to piece together Hollywood Shuffle. When I ran out of money, that's when I got inspiration. I was on the road doing comedy for like 3 weeks or 4 weeks. And when I came back, it was nothing but applications for credit cards, Visa, MasterCard, Preferred Visa, Preferred MasterCard, Chevron, Shell, Mobile. So then I figured out a scheme to basically charge the movie on credit cards. And I figured it out. And then when the film was finally done, Samuel Goldwyn bought the film. And then I said, hey, can I get my check now? You know, and he goes, what you need it? So you're desperate. I said, well, I charged the movie. You know, I charged the second half of the movie on credit cards and the bills are due. And he was like, you did what? And I said, well, I couldn't pay for catering, so I put it on the Visa. I couldn't get so-and-so, so I put gas on people's tanks for their cars. So I just figured it out. And Samuel Goldwyn Jr., who was the head of the studio at the time, he said, that's brilliant. We need to tell everyone your story. And that's kind of how I was, you know, born in Hollywood.
It's a treatment. I guess who was not talking about Sir Richard Attenborough earlier is Robert Townsend. 1987, he changed the course of film history with a remarkable film he directed, Hollywood Shuffle. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. One of the things that makes you, I think, a key part of black film history is using that financing to tell the story, because otherwise it's another black movie, which means it gets sort of relegated to a sort of tried and true tropey. Well, he made this movie and it's about black people. But what you did put you in the same lineage as Spike and Melvin Van Peebles, who basically made that part of their story. They understood if you do that, then it becomes a different way to get attention for the film. It becomes an independent film. It becomes an art film rather than a
yes.
black movie.
Yes. You know, Keenan and I, we grew up on quality comedy and television shows. And so I think what people really love about Hollywood Shuffle is that it's not that we, you know, anti-white folks or whatever. It was like we shared a real story that was funny and had heart. Rather than laugh at what was going on in Hollywood, we said, let's just laugh at the pain, not cry about it. You know, we can't, oh, I'm so mad. Let's do something. Let's make a movie and let's talk about what's really going on. But we did it in a funny way that I think a lot of people didn't understand satire. But Keenan and I are both students of comedy. And I think that's what really showed on the screen.
In addition to there being one black movie a year, there's also like one black movie star and one comedian. Baton at that point was just being passed from Richard Pryor to Eddie Murphy.
Yes, sir.
But that was like an anointment. That's like being crowned by the queen. It's like, we're going to pick one person, that's going to be it. And
yes.
And what you and Keenan said was, wait, there's more of us than one.
Yes.
Why should we wait for opportunity? I mean, what you did basically was part of what hip-hop did, which is to say, let's be entrepreneurial and seize the moment.
Yes. You know, I wasn't going to let anything stop me. The beautiful thing, Keenan says, hey, man, hey, Rob, we're two boys from the hood, so nothing can stop us. We're from the project. So it's like we can figure it out. We've done stuff before. So we figured it out. And the thing is that I grew up in the theater. So I took them through an acting boot camp. I took them through acting exercises. We basically called every actor that we had ever auditioned against and said, hey, man, you got something. Hey, you know, I'm not trying to hit on you, but you're really a good actress. And we would bring all these people together and I'd have them do acting warm-ups and improv. And we did all these sessions at the Rainbow Rehearsal Room on Franklin and Vineland. And people were like, ooh, this feels like, a, you know, like a movie. So I kind of took my theater training and transferred it to making this movie.
One of my favorite scenes in the movie is when you're sitting there and the guy turns next to you and goes, this gives you the whole sellout speech and basically is undermining you
yes.
for your audition. But that all felt incredibly real to me.
That happened. That really happened. Keenan and I were at the audition for A Soldier Story, and there was an actor that was talking to us. And I don't want to say his name because he's passed away, but he was like, brother, y'all going to go in there and do this crap? The white man got y'all tap dancing again, brother. I see. And then it was like Larry Wilcox, you know, and it's like, see you, brother. You know, let me get in here, get this audition. And our hands were messed up. We were like, did he just tell us not to go in there? And he went in there. So, yeah. So it was based on some real, you know, some real people.
What also?
And I said Larry Wilcox as a name. Not it wasn't. So, yeah, I just want to say.
Because people like, Larry Wilcox.
Robert said Larry Wilcox was there selling him. No, it was somebody else. I was just spitballing the name.
The lead up to the short for Black Acting School is so many of the tropes. It goes from slavery to then Step and Fetch It,
yeah.
Who somehow been moved to this era, to the idea of, in so many movies, including Gone with the Wind, slaves don't want to leave.
Right.
It goes from that to how these cliches are taught to people by white people. I mean,
yes.
It's maybe four, five of the most brilliant moments of film I've ever seen.
Well, thank you.
Still.
Thank you. I love movies. So when I started to really, you know, say I'm going to be a filmmaker and I started to look at all those movies, like I wanted to be Humphrey Bogart, which is why the black and white sequence was, you know, an homage to, you know, here's looking at you, kid. What, you know, that detective that comes in there and says, ah, so, you know, so. But when I looked at the Maltese Falcon and those other movies like Casablanca again, the black people talk really different. And I was like, oh, they're being directed.
No, sir. I was going right over there, Mr. Sam Ace.
Thanks again. Get out of my face, Sambo.
All right, sir. I'll go,
you know. And I just thought, they're being directed, and they had to be taught this because we don't talk like this. There's a whole nother...
Nobody talks like that.
Nobody talks like that, but... You know, when we were doing Hollywood Shuffle, I said, okay, I'll be that Step and Fetch. Like, no, I want to go back to Mazza House, you know. But it's kind of like what makes us laugh, and all of that stuff was real because you always have the one that he just beat us on Tuesday and whip us on Thursday and then we eat, you know. So all of that came out of real stuff.
If you want to get a special laugh at looking at Hollywood Shuffle, there's a version of it that a friend of mine pointed out to me, closed captioning, that the attempt to sort of get the dialogue in closed caption is his own other comedy. We'll take a break. My guest is Robert Townsend. 35 years ago, he changed the course of motion pictures with his film, Hollywood Shuffle. That's why we're still talking about it. There's more to come. Stay with us. Comedy and Pain with my guest, Robert Townsend, who was able to get, I think, a classic film out of both. The film we're talking about released 35 years ago is Hollywood Shuffle. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. What's still amazing to me is seeing people like Franklin Ajayi or very young Damon Wayans,
mm-hmm.
and everybody nailing performance. And when you were talking about an acting workshop and treating it as like kind of a boot camp, I saw what you were able to do in all those scenes. Everybody has a goal. Everybody has a point that they're playing. There's not sketch comedy. Sketch comedy acting versus acting is really different. And as you were talking about that acting boot camp, I realized what it is you were talking about it and how it paid off in so many instances in that movie.
When you have a lot of funny people, you got to say, okay, who's being funny in this moment and who's being the straight man in this moment or the straight woman? So when we went through the acting boot camp, I was trying to draw the funniest out of everybody, their magic. And Franklin Ajayi, still one of the funny, he lives in Australia now, still one of the funniest comedians ever. That was Damon's first time. And, you know, I'm coaching and directing and acting. And it's like, if you can find the best, like Paul Mooney, you know, he's, you know, recently passed, but Paul played the president of the NAACP. And, you know, Paul is doing his thing. And when I think about Dom Herrera and Lisa Minde, who played the casting director and the
My
writer.
Favorite sequence is when she's taking the phone call with her mother about a psychiatrist while a woman's trying to audition, just gets on the phone. Yes, thank you. No, but thank you.
Yeah.
And she's screaming as the director's. I mean, that must have happened to you at some point, too.
Yes. I mean, let me say this. The both of them improv'd all of that. You know, Keenan and I had written a few things down, but that's the magic of Lisa and that's the magic of Dom. Because when you have really talented, funny people like Murphy-esque, Murphonic, you know, that's all Dom. He was just, because we were like, let's push it. And then we're comedians. And so we're crazy. And he just went and Lisa went. And all of that is just like, they're both improv babies. So they just kind of pushed it. But all of that was our audition. So all that magic we captured.
It's funny, too, because I was thinking about the way the movie starts, which is we hear Bobby before we see him.
Yes.
First of all, just hearing that dialogue, it makes you laugh, but you're also thinking, please don't let this be what I'm afraid it's going to be. I mean, there is this moment of tension
Yes. That
starts the movie off. And I want you to talk about that, because that's a way of doing what that guy did to you in the Soldier Story audition. It's a bit of a shell game and playing to people's fear by having those kind of cliches being spoken off camera.
Well, the thing is that, you know, when you see the opening of Hollywood Shuffle, basically in the black, you hear, you know, yeah, you trying to kill me, man. Put the knife down, dude. And
you,
then...
No. He killed it. No, I want to make sure that we get
he killed
get the
it.
Patois.
He killed it, my brother. Yeah, the
he
grammar.
He was my onlyest brother.
My onlyest brother. The grammar, everything is off, because that's how we would get the scripts, where they would go, killed it. And we would go, killed it? It was he killed my brother. No. And then that same. No, he killed it. He killed it, my brother. My onlyest brother. Not only. Onlyest. I ain't be afraid of you. I ain't be. I'm not afraid of you. No. I ain't be. You know, and they would coach us. And we would go like, did you do that same audition? He said, yeah, man. Killed it. <You know? laughs> Who got it? The guy who can say killed it the best. He killed it.
I've actually shown this film when I've taught at UNLV or at Harvard or at AFI. And that moment, you can hear like the laughter and the kind of the fear, especially from the black students. Oh, God.
Yes.
Please don't let this be what I think is going to be. And then it's you, the young Bobby, the actor, auditioning with his little brother, who's his scene partner in this. I mean, so it starts off. It's both surreal and real, absurd and honest. I mean, there's so much that's packed into that very first scene.
Thank you.
I mean, talk about creating that moment, because you had to be aware of, as a filmmaker, what that does for people just to hear that over a black screen.
Well, you know, it's kind of like you want to set the audience up and then hit them with a curveball. So if you don't know what the movie is, you're like, oh, this is going to be so horrible. Oh, I can't wait. And then you go, oh, it's an actor in a bathroom with his 6-year-old brother, and the brother is running lines with him. And then the little brother, he's a little boy, and he's going, yeah, because you better have my money or I'm going to punch you in the face, ho. And you're like, this is a little kid. So I think part of it is like how, in a second, we set the tone of how absurd the life of a black actor is.
And probably still is, I would guess. I'm talking to somebody who probably knows all that. My guest is Robert Townsend. He's the director of, I think, a classic, Hollywood Shuffle, which had its premiere 35 years ago. We're here to celebrate that and to celebrate him as a storyteller and a filmmaker. We can't talk about this movie without asking what Eddie Murphy thought when he saw it. There's a section, let's say, that pays tribute to Eddie Murphy, and I don't want to give it anything else more away about it than saying that.
Well, what I would say is that back then, Keenan and I got into a big fight over that scene, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Because we're all friends, you know, Keenan, Eddie, all of us are friends. And so to explain the sequence, I said to Keenan, you know, Hollywood, if we're really going to do the Hollywood shuffle right now, they want every black actor to be Eddie Murphy. And back then, Eddie Murphy was huge. I mean, it's like...
And the only.
And the only. So Kevin Hart times 30 or whoever, the Will Smith times 50.
This is the time where the idea of having two black comedians in the same movie as co-stars was... would never have happened. It was insane.
unheard of. So when we go to auditions, they go, we're looking for the next Eddie Murphy. And so I decided to write a sequence. And I told Keenan, I said, you know, Bobby Taylor, the lead actor, should have a nightmare that he goes to this audition and there's 20 people in blackface and leather jackets looking like Eddie Murphy. And then the casting director starts freaking out saying, we want Eddie Murphy, we want Eddie Murphy. And then I show up in blackface and I start laughing like Eddie Murphy. And Keenan's like, no, don't do it, don't do it. I said, Keenan, it's funny, it's funny. And so I do it and I put it in the movie and then I get a call from Eddie. And then Eddie goes, man, everybody talking about Hollywood Shuffle. Rob, when can I see this movie? And then Keenan's head went down and I was like, oh God. And so we set up a screening for Eddie at Photochem in Burbank. He shows up with an entourage of 11, 12 people. We show the movie and they're laughing. And then it gets to the scene about Eddie. And the room gets quiet. And we hear the casting director, what we're looking for is an Eddie Murphy type. And the room is like dead. And I hear somebody hit Eddie's bodyguard. Eddie, they just said your name. They just said your name, Eddie. What is this? What is this? And Keenan's head goes down. I'm like, huh. And so the room is dead. And then as the scene plays on, Eddie starts to laugh. Ah, Rob, why y'all do me like that? Keenan, oh, that's wrong, man. That's wrong. Why y'all do me like that? Ah. Then... after the film was over with, everybody had left the screening room and Eddie was sitting there by himself. And so I went over and I apologized. I said, look, man, if you were offended by anything in the movie, I said, you make fun of people. I was just making fun because that's what they want us to be, Eddie Murphy. He says, no, Rob, what you've done is amazing. He says, I love this. You and Keenan figured it out. He says, look, I'm about to do this stand-up comedy film and I'm looking for a director. You want to do it? I was like, hell yeah. He says, okay, it's yours then. And it's going to be called Raw. And that's how I went on to direct, you know, Eddie Murphy Raw, because he came to the screening and he just loved what we did. And he was like, you got some chops.
What's it like for you? You're screening this movie for the first time for an audience.
The film made us laugh and touched us. Like the scene in the barbershop, don't give up on your dreams. So when Keenan and I laughed and enjoyed the film, that's all that really mattered.
So in effect, you're doing what filmmakers should do. You make the movie for yourselves first.
You've got to believe, it's got to make you cry. It's got to make you laugh. I was laughing, and not because it's my movie, but Keenan was really funny in certain scenes. Franklin Ajayi.
Keenan also is incredibly real in it. I mean, you're your resentful coworker at Winky Dinky Dog, as the break, as Jerry Curl in Devil. Yeah. I mean, every time he's on, again, this is all about how everybody steps up in performance terms.
Yeah, everybody was being honest and giving honest performance. So I just, you know, with Keenan, we were just having fun. And so when we finally showed the movie, maybe it was like the theater held like 70 people or 50 people, and the laughter was just loud, and then the oohs and the ahs, and we just kind of looked at each other, but we knew it was funny to us. And then when people, like, I think our sense of humors are both very universal. And so when people started laughing, we were like, okay, we're not crazy. We think this is really funny and twisted and, you know, and poignant and saying some real satirical things. And then after that, we knew we had something.
There had not been this idea that there could be more than one black perspective on comedy. And it came from that person who was like the big comedian, be it Eddie or Richard Pryor or other people before that. So what you guys did with this movie, sort of say, there are a wealth of perspectives out there. And all these perspectives have something to offer that's more than just this one take.
We didn't know what we were doing. We had, you know, had never made a movie, but we wanted to say something. And we weren't mad at anybody. We just wanted to say...
But there's anger in the movie, though. I mean, but there's anger. It's not an attack, but there's righteous anger in the film.
Yes, yeah. That's what I'm saying. We were being honest and authentic with our voices. It wasn't like just doing it. Because even in the film, the problem is not like, it's the white people making us do this. It's the black people that accept the roles, too. that don't stand up, and nobody, you know, and so the whole rallying last scene of, you know, Bobby Taylor saying, if we don't stop and stand up for ourselves, we're going to continue to do this. And so we were saying something, not trying to be on a soapbox or anything, but we, you know, we were just like, okay, let's just say something about how we really feel. And I think it's therapeutic and it's healing as well. And I think a lot of people, like even now, people will come up to me and go, man, I had this audition, Hollywood Shuffle. And it, you know, so it still goes on, but it's better than it was back then. A lot better.
The woman who plays your grandmother was somebody who'd been around for a long time. And in fact, you can see her in Cotton Comes to Harlem.
Helen Martin.
What was her response in getting the script and seeing what you were trying to do?
You know, here's the thing. She was a journeyman, journeywoman. She worked with Orson Welles back at the...
at the Mercury Theater.
Mercury Theater. So doing Macbeth, you know, the all-black version of Macbeth. So, you know, she was just an elder that was sending us love and support. And just, she understood it. And she loved that we were these young, fearless, young warriors with fresh legs ready to run the next leg of the race.
But I just thought, given what she represented, the people with whom she worked, she must have saw this and thought, I've been waiting my whole career to see something like this. Because so even working with Orson Welles, he's trying to tell black people how to be black people on stage. I mean, so it went back to the 30s. I'm sure it was well-intentioned, but it wasn't that different from He Killed It, My Brother. So I just wondered what she said to you. I mean, not just about she gave you love, but she must have said, in some ways, what took this so long, or where has this been?
I think it was more shock that we weren't looking for anybody's approval. We just said, we're doing it. You know, we're going to figure it out. Let's do it. And everybody was like, he's doing it? You're directing? Yeah, yeah. And I'm going to be in it, and I'm writing it, and I'm producing it with Keenan. We're going to do it, you know? And I think it was more like, wow. And it's like now you take it for granted that you can write, direct, produce a movie or a black folks doing it. And Keenan and I were talking about this the other day. Back then, it was like we were two runaway slaves and everybody thought we were crazy. Like, we ain't got to be on the cinematic plantation no more. We going to make our own movies. And the fact that we had the energy and the hustle and pulled it off. You know, but I think a lot of people now, when I think about, you know, all these new filmmakers, back then it was only Spike in New York and us.
And it's only Spike the year before. Before 1986, there hadn't been a Spike Lee making feature films.
Yeah, it was She's Gotta Have It in 1986, and then we came out in 1987. And so I think after that, seeds were planted, and then now the crop is here. You know, there's a lot of good stuff going on. You know, I'm hard on stuff, so there's not a lot that speaks to me. I'm still hard on it. I'm sorry, but it's better than it was.
I've seen Sorry before. That's not Sorry. My guest is Robert Townsend. We are celebrating.
I am never coming back. This treatment is treatment.
I believe you're not coming back. I wouldn't come back here either, except where else would I go? We're celebrating 35 years of his talent.
I love you, my brother.
I'm so thrilled to have you here. You know I appreciate you. I guess there's more to come or not. I don't know. Stay with us. One of independent film's funniest trailblazers, Robert Townsend, whose comedy innovation, Hollywood Shuffle, celebrates its 35th anniversary this year. Next, another African-American retake on Hollywood history, photographer Carell Augustus, who brings color to movie iconography with his photo essay book, Black Hollywood, Reimagining Iconic Movie Moments. For these interviews and other encounters about reclaiming pop culture, go to kcrw.com/thetreatment if you can't stay with us. Art is in the eye of the creators. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. If you're a person of color of a certain generation, and by that I mean somebody who's living and breathing, you've grown up watching movies and TV and thinking, what would it be like if, For example, an African-American woman were done up as Holly Golightly for Breakfast at Tiffany's. That just so happens to be the cover of the book Black Hollywood, Reimagining Iconic Movie Moments. The photographer and creator of this incredible collection, this book, is my guest, Carell Augustus. I can't thank you enough for doing this, man. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here, really, truly.
What I think is so fun about the book is you go from iconic posters to iconic moments to something I thought was really kind of interesting and telling, which is the character that for a lot of people, if you've grown up at a certain age, he's black. That is Green Lantern. If you've grown up with John Stewart as Green Lantern.
Green Lantern, that's right.
You don't think about Hal Jordan. So the idea of putting Green Lantern, a black Green Lantern, and that great pose, talk about that. Let's just start with that, because I think what this book does is kind of set iconography and imagery on his head, and there's no better way to do it than with a comic character like that.
I actually think that may expose a little bit of my own ignorance, because I was a Green Lantern fan for all of my life. I missed the original black version of who was Green Lantern. So I actually learned that during the shooting of this book, and I vacillated with whether I should still move forward with doing it. And then I said yes. And the reason I said yes is because of the movie that came out, that where he was a character. But actually before that, he was mentioned. And all of the movies and the images that I have seen of him, he was not black. So I just want to be clear that I am not taking away anything from the incredible actor that played him eventually. This is all having to do with the path I was led down and what I was led to believe and what I was shown.
Talk about how you make the selection for the shots and the scenarios you have in the book.
The original title that I had on Back to the Future was Black to the Future, but we didn't want to get sued. So because for utilizing the same font. So it was a compromise, but I sort of acquiesced because, you know, you don't want anybody being sued. So yeah, what I ultimately did was just things that for whatever reason were seared into who I am as a person, whether it was conscious, subconscious, or not. When this whole project came about, I wanted to focus on things that affected me, things that I remembered and wasn't even sure why I remembered it, things that ultimately shaped how you see yourself in the world. I just did a talk last night. My little cousin that was there, she's 22, and she actually posed a statement about how her growing up and seeing certain images of people that didn't look like her, how it carried with her through her entire life. And the standards of beauty and what that means. So a lot of this comes from me wanting to get that idea out and across and you know, have people think and talk and, you know, be careful what you wish for with that because you might get it. But ultimately it's just things that affected me as a kid and then coming into my, you know, adolescent and adulthood and realizing at some point how much imagery played in my own life.
Because you were saying conscious and sort of unconscious. What were some of the conscious ones that you want to get into the book? Because I'm wondering if you saw Breakfast at Tiffany's, that poster, which you got recreated so beautifully on the cover of the book, and said, let's start with that. What was the first thing for you?
So the first thing for me is I remember that movie sort of being on and during Thanksgiving and Christmas and sort of my family watching it, not watching it, vacillating in and out of, you know, watching the TV. But I remember Mickey Rooney playing an Asian man as a kid. And if we didn't know any better, we thought that was just proper, right? We didn't know that we had the option to be offended by this stuff because we thought we weren't worthy of getting an Asian person to play that character. Or it wasn't going to sell or whatever the excuse was. So I think a lot of it consciously came from me. Like that came from me. Robert Palmer came from me. Obviously, Marty McFly and Back to the Future came directly from me and sort of my own experiences. And just expanding upon that, I said, well, you know what? What if they redid Basic Instinct in 2023? I personally think Lauren London would be a perfect character for that. So when I met with her and spoke with her about it, she agreed. And and so we shot it. And, you know, just to put this into context, out of everybody I asked to shoot for this book, nobody asked me why. And I think that's incredibly poignant.
By the way, it's the treatment. My guest is Carell Augustus, the creator and photographer behind the incredible book, Black Hollywood, Reimagining Iconic Movie Moments. I start off by saying that you sort of run the gamut from iconic posters and shots to real people. Like I was saying at the opening, you have Joyful Drake as Ava Gardner. You've got Aditya Potter as Barbara Streisand. You got Chutney Ross as Farrah Fawcett. You sort of like play with both real and biopic by having Nelson Ellis do Ed Wood. But you also got Sally Richardson as Sophia Loren. A lot of women as iconic women. I thought that was the really interesting thing I wanted to talk to you about, because it's a way of using this book to sort of grab what was one standard and sort of say, well, let's look at the reflection on this side, because what it points out is how Black women are so often missing from that kind of glamour photography.
And that is absolutely right. The first time I saw a Black woman naked, semi-naked on television, it was on National Geographic. Now, this is a 12-year-old that had watched Porky's, or, you know, peeped around the corner and watched Porky's when I shouldn't have, or seeing Farrah Fawcett, or seeing Linda Carter, or seeing Cheryl Teagues, or the Charlie's Angels. So as a 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old Black boy, I thought beauty was encapsulated in these real pretty white girls. And these are beautiful women, but also my mom and my mom's sisters, my aunts, my cousins, they were beautiful. But I didn't get the opportunity to sort of experience that. It feels almost like I was cheated. Of course, within my household and my family dynamic, I saw my aunts dress themselves up and they had all the Black magazines. So it was always limited to within my household. When I left the house, I was just bombarded by all these other images of women that did not look like my beautiful Aunt Sheila with her braids in her hair and the beads. And I just thought that that was because she wasn't beautiful or wasn't seen as beautiful. And she absolutely was. So it's just a morphing of self-image and how you view yourself and your surroundings, if that makes sense.
First of all, it's so interesting to me that so many of the women you picked to have sort of supplanted by women of color were blondes. And also, even when we saw a woman during that era in braids and beads, it was a white blonde woman in tan.
Come on now. Right. Which I almost redid that. You know, I was going to redo that.
Oh my gosh, why didn't you? That would have been
perfect. I'm going to explain to you. I'm going to explain to you, because I thought that that was so egregious. So to ask a Black woman to now come on and put on a bathing suit, put on beads and braids and be Black, I just, like, you know, it was a little too much. It wasn't even pushing the envelope. It wasn't, you know, flipping anything on its head. The only difference in that shot was that it was Bo Derek, and it could have been Jane Kennedy. It could have been my aunt. It could have been my mom herself. So I thought about it. You know, but to ask these actresses in Hollywood to come out and put braids in their hair and put beads in there and let's go do 10 in Malibu, it would have been a really, really easy shot to do. I just thought it was so egregious what had happened in that particular frame that it wasn't even worth me going back out to try to redo it.
That's why I brought it up, because I thought so much what you do in the book is so much about being playful, but also turning things on their head. Let's not kid ourselves here. There's something revolutionary about doing this kind of thing. And I find myself really sort of tickled by the daring and the playful. That is both of those things simultaneously, which is the kind of the burden that Black culture has to deal with, isn't it?
It is. When I started in the beginning, I was actually trying to incorporate the actors to do, like I told Aisha Hines, I said, listen, we know what we're doing here. So when you give the salute, I want you to wink at the camera so that the people watching this know that we know what we're doing. And then somewhere along the line, you know, this was over a 10-year period. So I started to sort of readjust my thinking process and the messages I wanted to get across, just particularly. So I stopped doing that because I realized I was now trying to make the viewer comfortable. And that's not my job, because I was a young Black kid with my cousins watching the Dukes of Hazzard, rooting for a car called the General Lee with a Confederate flag on the hood, and nobody cared how that would affect me or the implications or anything. They just sent me into the world thinking that that's the way the world was. And I was just, you know, looking at it. So once I realized I was asking essentially for forgiveness for doing what I was doing, I stopped. I stopped making an excuse.
The image of Garcelle Beauvais in Addicted to Love, which is basically Robert Palmer, who would admit to us, because he loved Black culture, that song is itself is kind of rooted in Black culture. So playing a Black woman in both his place and the place of those women, I think is really is both kind of funny and trippy at the same time.
Just different people had different things about their character, things they had done in the past. And when I was talking to Garcelle, I said, Garcelle, I have this great idea for you. I want to redo the Robert Palmer videos that were so big in the 80s and was so iconic. But I want you to be every single person in the shot. She's like, get out of here. I said, no. I really want it. We'll do different poses. We'll change clothes. You'll be in the band. You'll have the tambourine. And you'll also be behind the mic. And she just absolutely loved it. She really loved it. And it's one of my favorite shots, the way it came out. You know, once again, as a 12-year-old kid watching these videos, once again, being bombarded with these images of beauty. And I just wanted to take some of that back, man. I just wanted to take some of that back and give it back to us for a second.
I'm almost surprised you didn't call the book, you know, Reclamation, because you're basically planting a flag in each one of these images. Just by the way, even that you like them, just because the lighting's got to be different for a person of color. So it becomes, they're all warmer pictures than they were originally, yeah. Which I think is really interesting, because you're talking about wanting to sort of have a sense of daring. But there's something really subtle, and I think subliminal, about there being warmth in every single shot.
Well, it was just really important for me to have everybody who showed up and everybody who gave themselves and their talent and their likeness to me to feel like the star in that exact moment. A lot of them told me, they said, nobody's ever pulled me to the side to do a creative shoot with just me. Usually I'm in a cast of people. They throw us against a white psych, which is just a white, you know, seamless, essentially. And we get cut out, we get thrown on a movie poster, and that's it. You know, and because we're number 4 or 5 on the call sheet, we're not the main people on the poster. We're oftentimes in the background. So I wanted to take that opportunity and just make everybody feel like this whole thing is about you. There's certain people in the book that I feel are just as talented as some of their contemporaries. And Corbin Blue comes to mind, who he sings, he dances, he acts, and he's on Broadway, he's on TV, he's on in movies. And I think he's just as talented as, you know, Zac Efron, who was his co-star in High School Musical. So I wanted to explore why one career did this and why the other career did that.
So often these images in these movies are kind of distant and cold. I mean, going back to the kind of the George Turrell photographs that you use as a model for the Dietrich, there's a kind of a coldness to them. But there is, in the way you shot these, a hand sort of extended to us to say, hey, we belong here too.
My goal was to simultaneously make everybody look beautiful, even though the shot didn't necessarily require that. Like for the Mommy Dearest shot featuring my dear, sweet, amazing friend, Kelly Stewart, that shot.
It's a really funny shot, by the way, too.
Yeah. And that shot, they actually had noxzema or something on the actress's face. This was all my call. I was the last person, the last stop. Of course, I collaborated with the people, but I did not want to cover Kelly Stewart's face. So I said, we're going to forego the noxzema because I want people to see you. I want your emotions and your face and your anger to come across. And I want you to be beautiful in that. We've been inspired by this stuff. I don't necessarily have to do it frame by frame, but I want you to just scream and people's brains will fill in the rest. So I'm glad that you, Elvis, recognize that, because I simultaneously wanted everybody to look and feel good while I was doing this.
Well, I mean, there are kind of funny touches throughout, like, you know, the Neil Brown Jr. in Die Hard, where he's got a much nicer cigarette lighter than Bruce Willis had in the original. But it's all filled with that kind of detail, though. I mean, these things that, if we know what we're looking at, I don't want to say Easter eggs, but things that sort of like give us clues that you know what it is you're creating and knowing that you're adding a level of glamour to each one of these things, because that's the thing that's so often not appearing in photographs with black stars.
And they are Easter eggs. There are a bunch of Easter eggs in there, because I think I mistakenly said one out loud. So that one's gotten all of the attention. And it was written about, I believe, in the book about my hand being the King Kong hand. But like you pointed out, the lighter and just different things throughout, there's just a few Easter eggs that will cause people to pick the book back up and sort of see things again. You know, it's like seeing Hollywood again for the first time.
My guest is giving us something to look for in his book, which you should get, by the way, is
yes.
Carvel Augustus. The book is Black Hollywood, a great photo creation book. Subtitle is Reimagining Movie Moments. And we can't, since you brought up Dukes of Hazzard in the first half, we can't go and not talk about your Gone with the Wind shot where you recast Scarlett O'Hara.
Yes, yes, yes. So I remember being a kid and my mom, sitting with my mom to watch this movie, and she goes, oh, you have to watch the scene, watch the scene. I did not understand the scene, but the scene came up where the woman said, as God is my witness, I'll never go hungry again. So as an 8-year-old with my mom loving that scene and not understanding the scene, I knew that it was incredibly impactful for whatever reason. Obviously, as I grew, I understood what was happening in the scene. And because my mom was so affected by it, and then I watched my mom sort of have struggles as a, you know, an adolescent and, you know, a teen, and always having her passion for that scene in my head, I thought it would be a great ode to her.
And I think because of moments like that, because of self-determination, it's a moment that a lot of Black women sort of get behind, even though they understand that the movie has other messages. And I found myself thinking all that, too, as I was looking at, you know, you were very conscious about making sure that it's Afrocentric hair and that she's not wearing a wig or trying to recreate Vivien Leigh's hair in that moment.
Well, first off, Shanoa has the most incredible dreads I've ever seen. And also in the Psycho shot, Simbi Calli, they came to me and they said, hey, do you want us to put a wig on her for Psycho? And I said, absolutely not. Do you know the scene? So we watched the scene, and the woman had like sort of like a pixie cut. And I said, this buttresses my point. Keep the short twists, and she's going to scream, and it's going to be a great shot, hopefully. And it resells the photograph, doesn't it? It resells the moment. You believe that Simbi Calli is being accosted by some psychomaniac, because she's just spotting him for the first time with her short twists and all. So many things like that just naturally came together by way of how the styles that people have, particularly Black women, so much came about just from them showing up as themselves.
What I want to say about the book too, Carvel, is that there's an enormous amount of confidence in it. And I wonder if you were feeling that from the outset, if that's something that came to you as you built from one of these sort of layouts to another.
I live in Hollywood. I'm not in Hollywood. I live there. So I've learned how to fake things a lot. and you know, I personally have always been confident in the work, but I shot this over a 10 plus year period. So my outlook on the work sort of vacillated when people weren't responding to it.
Wait a second. People weren't responding to it? What do you mean? When did that happen?
Well, I do. The amount of rejection I got before, as I tried to go into the next phase of, you know, getting a group of people that believed in the work just as much as I did, saw the potential, and I didn't have to sort of explain a whole lot. Nobody asked me why we're doing this when I was shooting. Not Vanessa Williams, not Vivica Fox, not Shamar Moore, not Lauren London, not Jay Ellis. Nobody asked why, because we get it. Making the leap from that to the mainstream, this is where all your whys are going to come in. And because I never had to answer that question, I never really gave it much thought. So there was a tantamount of rejection that, you know, I was to the point where I was going to have my book printed at Costco and drive around and sell people copies for $15, because I was so passionate about the work getting out. But I also knew at the same time that if I met a group of people that could understand where it was coming from, they would understand it, they would get it, and they would get behind it. And luckily, that happened.
I have to tell you, one of the things that made me laugh out loud, because it really felt like a reclamation, which is why I keep going back to that word as the title, is having Tiffany Hines and Flashdance, because basically there's a whole lot, so much to say about that. It could be its own book, but that is a pretty audacious thing to do. And I want to ask you about why you did that. That must be the one you get the most questions about. Am I wrong about that?
So I actually have not gotten a lot of questions about it, but it makes me hot under the collar in the sense that when I explain it, it makes perfect sense to me. So I love Jennifer Beals. Flashdance, I've been seeing since I'm in the third grade. And, you know, that she was the epitome of what I thought women should look like and all that. And my entire life, I thought Jennifer Beals was Italian or white. I did not know, because it wasn't mentioned at all in the movie, that her father happens to be African American. So I love Jennifer Beals. I would never do anything to take her blackness away from her. This is also an ode to the kid that I was, and then that became the 13-year-old I was, that became the 17-year-old I was, that always thought that she was of Italian or Caucasian descent. And, you know, perhaps if in that movie I had seen a picture of her and her dad and her mom, and her dad was black, I would have had a different outlook on it, but I didn't. And, you know, I have not met Jennifer Beals, but should I ever meet her, I will make sure that she understands that I, you know, love her and support her. And what she did for me as a kid was phenomenal. So, and I have several mixed race people in this book who identify as black or cast themselves as black or have been casted as black. And for me, that was just something that was missed when I shot that. And Tiffany Hines and I had the conversation about it. And once again, I was not going to not do it because it felt like an apology. So I'm not going to apologize about it, but I definitely will explain where I was coming from. And hopefully Jennifer Beals will hear this message and give me a call, because I would love that.
The book, a great collection of photos, is called Black Hollywood, Reimagining Iconic Movie Moments. And my guest is Karel Augustus. Again, thank you.
Thank you.
Reimagining Iconic Movie Moments through the lens of photographer Karel Augustus. His photo book is Black Hollywood. Next, it's The Treat. Director Brett Morgan on someone whose career is all about recontextualization. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treat Bent, and this is Brett Morgan with The Treat. Brett's new documentary examines the mind of David Bowie. It's only fitting that Brett's treat turns to a Bowie album that didn't fall upon deaf ears. Director Brett Morgan of Moon Age Daydream with another perspective on David Bowie.
Hi, I'm Brett Morgan, and this is The Treat. I'm going to talk a little bit about a David Bowie album most people are not all that familiar with, but as I studied Bowie over the last 7 years, became, for me, one of his most, if not the most seminal work, which is an album called Outside. Outside was an album that Bowie did in 1995 with Brian Eno, and it was essentially a return to form. Bowie had been kind of in the commercial wilderness for several years, 84 to 87, and then joined Tin Machine as a sort of palate cleanser, and then had a kind of famous return to form with Black Tie White Noise, which in retrospect is not really a return to form. But when he reconnected with Brian Eno, who he ran into at his wedding with Amon, he had arrived at a place in his career where he sort of arrived at a new station. Amon introduced a whole new kind of world that had sort of eluded him. And he was able to kind of put down roots and start building a home. And with from that vantage point, he then decided to kind of jump back into work with a new passion and vigor that had eluded him. What Bowie did back in 95 was very similar to what he had done in Berlin in the early 70s, which is just strip everything down and go back to role playing, game playing, really trying to get as far out of his comfort zone as possible. I say the mother's brutal vermin. He started painting with greater frequency, and he would often use his paintings to inspire his musical collaborations. The themes that would endlessly excite him, that he would return to over and over and over again. In fact, Moon Age, we open with the quote from Nietzsche, which David extended to both James Joyce in literature and Einstein in science and Freud in psychoanalysis, and how all of the great minds were kind of deconstructing our belief system. And if we no longer had a God to believe in, where were we going to put our faith? And David believed that that created a deep sense of anxiety, coupled with the fact that, you know, over the past 300 years, we went from an agrarian culture to the world that we're living in, and how did the brain evolve to take in all of this new information? And what David was ultimately doing was creating a soundtrack for that. He was both inspired by what he was sort of experiencing in the culture around us, and through his love to Amon, to jump back into the deep end. And I think as a result, he produced possibly one of his greatest timestamps of his career. They beat on the outside, and I'll stand by you now. Not
tomorrow. It's happening now. As always, Rebecca Mooney produces and edits the program. I welcome her perspective. Katie Gilchrist mixes, and I need the context she brings. Help this week from Anna Buss and Laura Kondrajian. Yet another better Saturday via music from Ann Litt's Purview. I'm hoping it might bring us So Right by David Bowie. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.